We've been waiting. We had a late floor session, which throws a monkey wrench into everything around here. We are going to start with a, council, do we have the amendment that we had talked about on Senate Bill 965? Was that the emergency clause?
We do, Senator.
Okay. We are going to open a work session on Senate Bill 965. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
The committee. Senate Bill 965 creates a private cause of action for invasion of personal privacy. There is a dash 5 amendment in your packet as well that is applicable to this measure. The measure itself creates a cause of action for damages if the plaintiff establishes that the defendant knowingly made a visual recording of the plaintiff in a state of nudity without the consent of the plaintiff and at a time when the plaintiff was in a place and in a circumstance where they had a reasonable expectation of privacy, or that for the purpose of sexual gratification, the defendant was in a location to observe the plaintiff in a state of nudity without the consent of the plaintiff, or for the purpose of sexual gratification of any person, the defendant knowingly made a visual recording of an intimate area of the plaintiff without the plaintiff's consent. The Dash 5 amendment adds one additional grounds for this cause of action, and that is the ground where the defendant, without the consent of the plaintiff, knowingly disseminates a visual recording of the plaintiff in a state of nudity in a place or in circumstances where the plaintiff had a reasonable expectation of personal privacy. The amendment, the Dash 5 amendment, that is, contains an emergency clause and makes the cause of action applicable to conduct that occurs after the effective date.
Thank you, Council. Committee, we had, I had discussed, this came to us from Senator Brown, who had a constituent with a very serious situation that provoked this bill. We had actually considered the idea of trying to make it retroactive and decided not to go there. It's legally kind of murky. So kind of went the middle ground and put an emergency clause on it to allow quick use of this protection, but not retroactively. So is there any questions of council? Senator Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of curious, we've got two blanks on line 22 and line 23 of the original bill. I don't see those being filled in by the amendment. What's up?
What's up, Doc?
Those are Senator Chair, Senator Byer. Those blanks are the blanks left to be filled in for the amount of liquidated damages, not less than, but more than. And that, I wish I had a good explanation for why those were left blank.
Oh, I do too. Let's see.
My next question would then be, are we going to ship out a bill that's got two blanks in it?
No, I don't think so, Senator Byer. I didn't notice that myself. So I'm just looking over these other...
How come I've got... I think it's a bill for me.
Well, Biddy's for a moment. I'm going to just check.
Littlest detail.
I just think that this is on page 2. That's a conceptual. Yeah. Okay, committee. Thank you again, Senator Byer, for once again finding saving our bacon here for us. What I was looking for is I thought I recalled that we dealt with this and took it out, but I'm not finding any evidence for that. Okay. I think what we will do is we'll close the work session on this and get back with Senator Brown to get her guidance on this. Close the work session on 965. Okay. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 216. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 216 is the Cypre bill, which would allow the Attorney General to make a claim for recovery on behalf of class members that fail to submit claims to monetary judgments that are resultant from a class action lawsuit. It permits the Attorney General to make disbursements from those monies based on the terms of the class action judgment. There was a public hearing on this on April 4th. There are two proposed alternative amendments. Both of the amendments have to do with the disposition of the unclaimed property, the unclaimed damages that result from the class action. The Dash 1 amendment would require the Attorney General to treat any of those unclaimed damages as unclaimed property amounts and deposit those funds into the common school fund after the prescribed waiting period has expired.
We need more money in there.
The Dash 2 amendment is an alternative to that. The Dash 2 would require the Attorney General to distribute one half of any unclaimed amounts collected under this provision to the Common School Fund and the other half to the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account.
Thank you. We have Kevin Neely back there somewhere. If anybody has any questions on the bill, we had extensive hearing on it. Is there any questions of counsel or Mr. Neely? Senator Whitsitt.
Madam Chair, just for my own edification, what is the Consumer Protection and Education Revolving Account?
It's a division in the Attorney General's office where they enforce consumer protection matters, and I'm not going to pursue that amendment. So if you're interested in pursuing the amendment, I'd be happy to have them up here. But
That's fine. I'd like to hear the amendment better.
Okay. Thank you.
Good.
Senator Walker.
Well, I do too, Madam Chair. I want all the money for the Common School Fund because we desperately need money for schools, and they can get money in the consumer protection account by assurance of voluntary compliances and other issues.
No call. They can do no call.
They could do no call.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions? Senator Prezanski?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1s into Senate Bill 216.
Senator Prezanski has moved this Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 216. Is there any discussion? Any objection?
I object.
Would you please call the roll, Dale? Thank you.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Prezanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Six ayes, ayes, one nay.
Senator Prezanski?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 216 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 216 is amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
I think no case is made for this bill, and you've got people out there you're trying to protect who don't think they have been harmed. I think the AG's looking for a way to fund it, and that's why I'm opposing it.
Senator Beyer, to rebut that, I have a large pile of clutter in my house I'd like to share with you. Thank you, but I note your objection. Would you call the roll, please?
Madam Chair, I just want to comment that if we don't do this, the money goes back to the person who got sued. Why should they get money back for doing something wrong? So I think the money needs to come here.
Are you feeling comfortable? The vote you're about to cast, Senator Walker?
Vote my what?
With the vote you're about to cast?
Yes, I'm feeling very comfortable. Very good with me. I just need to make sure that's very abundantly clear that I'm comfortable with my vote.
I appreciate that. Okay, any other discussion? Dale, would you please call the roll?
No.
Says Senator Beyer.
You know the vote now. Again, keep on.
Senator Prezanski.
Aye.
Senator Ringo.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt.
No.
Vice Chair Starr.
No.
Chair Burdick.
Aye.
Four ayes, three nays.
Okay. Okay, I will carry this bill. Okay, now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1011. Council.
Committee, Senate Bill 1011 had a public hearing last week on the 14th, and this is the bill that would provide a statute of limitations for causes of action based on injury or death resulting from the substance known as COX-2 inhibitors.
Okay, we had a public hearing on this bill, and we have Brad Higbee in the audience if anybody has any questions about this bill. And I believe we don't have any amendments.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There are no amendments.
All right. Senator Prezansky, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1011 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Prezansky has moved Senate Bill 1011 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
No.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to say I think this is an excellent bill because it gives rights to people in Oregon to have recovery for injuries that they had no way of knowing occurred at the time the statute of limitations expired. And really this is a response to the fix of the, quote, Gladhart bill from last session, but it was a loophole in that fix. I think if you accept the idea that people ought to have recovery because of somebody else's negligence, and that's what our tort system is all about, that somebody's negligence that causes an injury to somebody else, there ought to be a recovery. This bill allows that recovery to occur. There's other examples where we've done this, where we've changed the statute of limitations. Former Representative Kevin Mannix did it for one narrow case where somebody was barred from the statute of limitations, and they said, you know, the defendant's an out-of-state manufacturer. We've got an Oregon victim. We ought to let the claim go forward. Former State Senator Neil Bryant did it on the case involving the exploding gas tank, where the woman suffered horrible injuries and yet was barred from recovery and what was clearly a negligent design. And so, I mean, this bill is intended to allow a lot of people to recover for injuries where they otherwise couldn't recover against an out-of-state defendant, so there would be no economic consequences to any Oregon corporation. I think this bill makes very good sense.
Thank you for your comments, and I might note that this doesn't prejudge the substance of any of those cases that we saw here in committee. It just merely gives people a chance to bring it up in court, and I think the work that was done last session was very good on the Gladhart fix, and I'm convinced in my mind that had this been known at that time, that original bill would have turned out differently, and I think it's very appropriate that we make this fix today. Senator Wissett.
I just simply have a fundamental problem with changing a statute of limitation retroactively.
Appreciate that, Senator Wissett. Okay, Senator Prezansky, who's moved Senate Bill 1011 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, will you call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Prezansky?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker? Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
No.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Four ayes, three nays.
Senator Ringo, would you care to carry this bill?
I'd be glad to carry it.
Senator Ringo will carry the bill. Okay. What else do we have on? Senate Bill 333. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 333. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 333 would increase the maximum amount of damages that may be pled in tort actions for which the court must award attorney's fees to a prevailing plaintiff. There is a -1 amendment before you. Essentially, the current law is that when the damages that are pled are $5,500 or less, the court must award reasonable attorney fees in certain circumstances. And this measure would increase that maximum amount of damages where attorney's fees are available to a prevailing plaintiff to $7,500. The -1 amendment makes the following changes. It would require the plaintiff, when making the written demand, to provide the demand to the defendant's insurer as well as the defendant personally. The timeline is the same. It is within 10 days before filing a complaint. And then the plaintiff would also be required to include documentation of the injury or the damages that are in the plaintiff's possession or reasonably available to the plaintiff at the time of that written demand. The last change the Dash 1 Amendment makes is that it clarifies that it applies to any action commenced on or after the effective date, which would be January 1, 2006.
Madam
Chair. Senator Ringo.
I introduced this bill, and the committee may recall that there was some testimony from the insurance industry where they raised some specific concerns. There was a defense attorney, Billy Sine, who made some comments that I think were valid on how this could be made more workable, I guess more fair to both sides. My understanding is that Billy Sine has agreed that the Dash 1 amendments are fine. I haven't had a chance to look at them carefully, and frankly, as I'm looking at them right now, there's something that I would like to address further, and so I would just ask you to not move this today and let me continue to dig away at it.
Okay, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 333, and we will carry to Monday's meeting Senate Bill 913 and 965, and carry. How much time do you want, Senator Ringo? Monday?
Monday would be fine.
And we will carry to Monday's meeting Senate Bill 333. Close the work session. Okay, now. Okay, Mr. O'Leary, I think you're out of here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
May I leave for a short while now?
You want to do this? Okay. All right, we will now take up a work session on Senate Bill 492. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 492 comes here from the Committee on Judiciary, creates a new provision of the Motor Vehicle Code for failure to stop or remain stop for a pedestrian, repeals current statute concerning both such conduct. We have the Dash 2 amendments in front of us, which is a replaces the bill and is just a pretty much Dash 2. Right. We just received them from the meeting. And I would ask maybe if Senator Krasinski could help me in this because I think he has a better understanding of them than I do of them.
Senator Krasinski, would you like to do that or?
Thank you. We may also want to have representatives from the City of Portland to come up, but the Dash 2s incorporated what was the intent of Senate Bill 591, which was scheduled today for a work session. If the committee remembers, there was some discussion on Senate Bill 591 regarding a court that made decisions that said that there was a confusion and maybe drafting error as to the intent of the legislature as it pertained to crosswalks and individuals walking across roadways. And the court deemed the statute that as it was written during 2003 to basically distinguish and make a separate lane out of the out of a bicycle lane or the lane where vehicles might be parked. The intent of 591 was to have the roadway from the curb to the inside of the motor vehicle lane to be classified as one lane and not to have separate lanes. That's the intent of 591. In my understanding, with the assistance of the City of Portland, Mr. Landauer, he had Legislative Council draft the Dash 2s to incorporate that concept of 591 so it would be in place with 492. The reason that needed to be done as compared to keeping them separate is apparently the way that 492 is currently written, it would actually remove the section that 591 would be amending, and so we would basically not fix the issue that the court had. In this way, my understanding is that we will, one, take care of the intent of 492 as it was currently drafted, as well as the concerns from the court's decision in 591.
Okay, so Senator Brzezinski, to clarify this, we will not need 591 because it's incorporated in the Dash 2.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Ms. Landauer, did you have anything to add to that?
Just briefly, thank you, Chair Burdick. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations. I've asked Mark Lear, who's our traffic investigation manager for the City of Portland, to just briefly outline you for you the intent of the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you.
Mark Lear, City of Portland, Office of Transportation. We, along with other local governments in the state, continue to think that the Stop and Stay Stop bill passed last session is one of the best things we've done recently to improve pedestrian safety. This bill fixes two problems, or technical problems that were identified, one that Senator Pruszynski just summarized, and the other just to clarify that at signalized intersections, drivers are required to stop and stay stopped for one lane plus 6 feet of the adjacent lane. And that was a compromise that we crafted with local governments, Plan Pedestrian Coalition. So we feel real positive that we're in a really strong place now, local governments and ODOT, to go out and do education on this bill, and we look forward to doing that as soon as this bill is in effect.
Thank you. And as the author of the original Stop and Stay Stop bill, with the help of the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, I want to thank the City of Portland for the enforcement efforts that you've done. I notice a very distinct difference now, walking as both a pedestrian and driving as a driver, in the actual change in behavior. And that came about because of your enforcement efforts. So I appreciate it, and I appreciate the work you put in on the compromise. I think it's a good solution.
Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Barr, why don't you guys stay put in case.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't know if the questions are for them or for Senator Pruszynski, but I'm just trying to figure out in your sub 2 down there that a bicycle lane does not count as a lane. Is that what I...
The intent is that, based on this judge's ruling, he interpreted that those are separate and distinct lanes for the purpose of the crosswalk interpretation. And what we're attempting to do is make certain for the application of the pedestrian crosswalk that those lanes are not looked at separately, because if it did, it would basically keep pedestrians in more risk or potential risk, because the vehicles could actually move and advance through the crosswalk sooner than what was intended by the legislation in the last session.
So, for clarify, under current law and current interpretation of current law, a bicycle lane is considered a traffic lane.
It is a traffic lane. It will continue to be a traffic lane, except for in the interpretation of the crosswalk, is the way I understand it. It's not going to change the definition of making it a no longer a separate lane in the general context of the lanes within a highway.
But for the purposes of a pedestrian, if you're up there, the current law says if there is a bicycle lane and the pedestrian is crossing in front of you, as soon as the person gets across the bicycle lane, you can go. But this, if this is the pass, you have to wait until that person gets across the next lane of traffic beyond the bicycle lane.
Currently, if I remember how the pedestrian rule works, is that when a person is crossing the roadway, you basically have to stay stopped and cannot move basically for two lanes until the individual, let's say the bicycle lane, if they're in the bicycle lane, you would have to wait until the person actually crossed, wouldn't be crossing. A vehicle would have to stay stopped at that point that was adjacent to the bicycle lane, as well as the lane that's next to the to that lane of travel, that traffic lane. So basically there's a buffer of two lanes between movement of the vehicles and where the pedestrian is in the crosswalk.
So in effect, this bill adds the width of the bicycle lane, if there is one, to that.
To the outside lane of motor vehicle lane.
Under certain circumstances, if you have the lane that the car, the crosswalk, and then the lane that the car is in, and then the pedestrian goes across that lane, if there's another lane before the bicycle lane, then this is irrelevant. But if there's a bicycle lane in between them, then they have to, that doesn't count for one lane of separation.
That's what I
thought it did. Right. Okay. Let's see. Okay, Senator Starr, do you have a motion on the Dash 2 amendment?
Yeah, I'll move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 492.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 492. Is there discussion?
Sure.
Objection? Senator Ringo.
I think I have issues with this bill, and I guess I come from Beaverton, where we have massive traffic jams, and I'm kind of coming late to this discussion, but we passed a similar bill last session relating to when somebody can make a turn across, and I think the bill that we passed is too restrictive.
Right, and this changes it. Mr. Landauer, because this deals with the congestion situation. So
okay, then that's right. And I apologize for, she's glaring at me, and she has a right to.
Why don't you clarify, because it is a little complicated.
Madam Chair, again, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland, Senator Ringo, to get to your question, I believe. In the existing law, there frankly was a mistake, and probably a minor mistake, in that it didn't clarify that it needs to be a stop and stay stop for a lane plus the adjacent lane. And this would be at a signalized intersection. As a result, a vehicle driver would have to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian to cross the entire surface of the street.
Right.
So this bill, 492, is an attempt to correct that. The other thing that we're attempting to do here is to deal with traffic congestion, particularly at signalized intersections. And you'll see under Section 2, capital E there, where we're not saying a lane plus an adjacent. We're saying the travel lane plus 6 feet. That will allow, in our engineers' minds, the opportunity for vehicles to make those turns at signalized intersections. So we're trying to deal with congestion issues with the Dash 2 Amendment.
Okay.
Senator Ringo.
I like everything you just said. I'm looking at the staff summary sheet where it says the measure would create a new Class B traffic violation for failure to stop. Do the amendments make that moot?
No.
I'm sorry, Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo. It's my understanding, looking at the existing law, that it is already a Class B traffic violation, so that would remain unchanged under 492, as I understand it.
So, just follow up, Madam Chair. So, it's not correct to say that this measure would create a new Class B traffic violation.
No, sir.
Okay, I'm fine.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion of the Dash 2 amendments?
Yeah, I think you ought to be able to miss pedestrians by 6 feet or 3 feet.
Stop that. Senator Beyer, anybody? Any objection?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm still trying to work. It seems to me like this bill is doing two things. It's trying to make it less restrictive, but then it's adding that bicycle lane, which makes it more restrictive. So, in fact, at best, it's neutral. If there's bicycle lanes out there.
I think this goes back to the original bill. We had testimony from the head of the traffic division in Portland who said that some of the traffic pedestrian accidents they've had actually resulted when somebody would get just barely past the car and then turn around, or, you know, that there had to be a little bit of leeway for safety. And so this is a, you know, for signalized intersections, this is a compromise so that especially, you know, cars turning on a red light, for example, would not have to, would not have to allow that much leeway, but would have to allow a little bit more leeway than just brushing them as they go by, which was happening before. Okay, are there other objections? Why don't you call the roll on this?
This is pro bicycle vote.
Kind of.
I'd say pro pedestrian. Bicycle vote.
It's pro car, Roger.
No.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Okay. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 492 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 492 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
I just want to say that I'm going to look at it further, and if I
think it actually does improve that poor law that was created last session that I hope I voted against.
What did you just say?
He said he might be voting for it later.
Why don't you call the roll? Dale, thank you.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Krasinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye. Okay, it passes. I will carry that bill and ask for Senator Krasinski's help on the floor. Okay, now, what do we have next? We will, what's this?
I'm not talking on this one. Hearings and possible work sessions. We've done all the ones.
Okay. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 127.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 127 comes to you from the Oregon State Police, and the bill includes within the definition of sex crime for the purposes of sex offender registration any crime that under federal law will require a person to register as a sex offender, requires a person required by federal law to register as a sex offender in Oregon to register or be in violation of the Oregon law.
Okay, we have Don Mellon from Oregon State Police. Welcome. Thank you, Charlie.
Oh, you're welcome.
Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Dan Mellon with the Oregon State Police, and I'm here to provide testimony for Senate Bill 127. The intent of the bill is to ensure that any person convicted of a sex crime in another jurisdiction, requiring them to register as a sex offender under federal law, will have to register as a sex offender if they move to Oregon. ORS 181597 requires certain persons to report as sex offenders upon moving into the state and requires certain non-residents to report as sex offenders. Subparagraph 2A and the obligation to report applies to persons convicted in another jurisdiction of a crime if the elements of the crime would constitute a sex crime. The problem with this language is that the sex crime referred to is taken from the list of sex crimes in ORS 181594. Some federal sex crimes involve child victims, but the definitions do not match the language of Oregon sex crimes. And as an example, persons convicted of the federal crime of possession of child pornography are not subject to sex offender registration in Oregon. Federal law enforcement agencies do not register sex offenders convicted of federal sex crimes, but federal law mandates that the states maintain registries for convicted sex offenders, and ORS 181597-2C requires only those persons required to register in another state to register in Oregon. If the person is released from federal or military prisons and immediately moves to Oregon, depending on the state of release, registration may not be required. Oregon law, as an example, requires a person to register within 10 days of establishing a residence in Oregon. This demonstrates how the person may not have registered in another state, even though their release documents indicate that they are required to register under federal law. The United States Department of Defense uses a DD Form 2791, Notice of Release, Acknowledgement of Convicted Sex Offender Registration Requirements, to provide notice to military prisoners of their obligation to register as sex offenders upon release from military prisons. A copy of the form is attached to this testimony for your convenience. OSP receives these forms, which indicate the projected address the offender will move to. The DD 2791 clearly states the offender is subject to sex offender registration under federal law. It's possible that failure to register these offenders would result in a determination that Oregon is not in compliance with the Wetterling Act, potentially jeopardizing federal law enforcement grant funds. The United States Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Prisons, uses the BP S647.051 Sex Offender Release Notification Form to notify states of the pending release of federal sex offenders from federal prisons. A copy of the form is also attached. These forms indicate that the offender is subject to registration under federal law and provide the projected address the offender will move to in Oregon. Failure to register these offenders may also result in a determination that Oregon is not in compliance with the Wetterling Act. A solution would be to require any person convicted of a sex crime in a military or federal court requiring sex offender registration by federal law, regardless of whether the crime would constitute a sex crime in this state, who are released or moved to Oregon to register within 10 days of establishing residence, and thereafter within 10 days of the date of birth or any change of address. Senate Bill 127 accomplishes this and closes this loophole, allowing certain persons to avoid sex offender registration, even with federal documentation advising them of the obligation to register. Oregon State Police requests that the committee consider if this change to sex offender registration law could be made retroactive to September 28, 1991, when lifetime sex offender registration was enacted into Oregon law. And if this is not possible, then the state police requests emergency enactment of this bill, if passed, to close the loophole as expeditiously as possible. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill, and I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you. Two questions right off the top. One is, what is the Wetterling Act?
Chair Burdick, the Wetterling Act is the federal law that requires sex offender registration in all 50 states in the United States.
Okay, and that was enacted when?
1994.
Okay, because the other question is related, and that is, why did it take so long to establish this problem that seems to date back to 1991?
The problem came to light over the course of the last few years, and we're talking about maybe a dozen offenders. So it's not a big pool of offenders. What's happened over the course of time is these offenders have come out of either military prisons or been released by the Bureau of Prisons and moved to the state of Oregon. Most of them registered as sex offenders responsibly because they had executed this form that says, I understand that I'm going to have to register as a sex offender. When they arrived in the state of Oregon, in one case, one of the offenders went to a U.S. attorney and said, I was convicted of the federal crime of child pornography. The language of that crime, which is just possessing the material, is not the same as the language of the Oregon State Encouraging Child Sex Abuse, which says that the person must possess the material for the purpose of arousal of either that person or another person. The for the purpose addition in the Oregon State statute differentiates from the federal crime. And since the language is different, the U.S. attorney said that those two crimes are not the same. They're similar, but they're not the same. Once we received that letter from the U.S. attorney, we then requested advice from the Oregon State Department of Justice. And they agreed with the U.S. attorney that the two crimes were not the same, and therefore the crime of conviction did not constitute the elements of a crime, of a sex crime in Oregon. And that's the difference that we have.
Thank you. Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Detective, I guess the only question, since the Wetterling Act went into effect in 1994, did it have a retroactivity clause or something that required individuals who had been convicted under a federal law prior to the enactment of that act to report? And I guess the question really is, if we are, what I'm hearing you ask us to do is go back to 1991 when we required people within Oregon, with Oregon convictions or similar convictions from other states. I just want to make sure that we don't, let's say, require something that may not have been required under the federal act, because I'm just concerned that we may be setting ourselves up for some challenge.
Mm-hmm. Chair Burdick, Senator Pozanski, the point's well taken. The state of Oregon was ahead of the federal government in terms of sex offender registration by enacting lifetime registration in 1991. And I agree with your point that rather than going back to 91 when the state of Oregon had registration in place, we should likely use the federal deadline of 94.
Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pazanski, it's been a while since I looked at that, but what I remember when this issue first came up, I believe the courts found that there was not an ex post facto problem here because it wasn't considered punishment.
As counsel, under what we passed in 91, did that require people that were, let's say, convicted in 1980 of a crime that would require registration under the Act to actually start registering at that time? Or was it for convictions that occurred after the passage of the 1991 statute or law?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Przanski, I don't remember, but I see Dan Malin is indicating he does. The only thing I do remember, and I said it's been a while since I looked at it, that when the issue came up before the federal courts, because there was a retroactive provision, if not in Oregon, in other states, and the argument that was raised that it was ex post facto, it was applying punishment after conviction, and the court said, no, this is not considered punishment.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Please.
I have no problem with us going as far back as we can go. It might be if counsel could dust off that research and we could just see where we're at and make sure that we're going to cover what we need to cover without setting us up for some type of a challenge that would be have validity.
It does seem that we should give serious thought to 1994, since that is the underlying problem.
Chair, but I'd extend under Przanski to answer your question on the 91 date. The ex post facto was not considered punishment or further punishment, and therefore registration was applied to any person, not the conviction date. The conviction date did not become a triggering event for registration, but any person who was convicted, released from incarceration, released on probation or parole, or discharged by the court on or after that September 28, 1991 date, would then be obligated to register as a sex offender. So that did reach back to those who were already under supervision or incarcerated for sex crimes.
Okay.
Okay. I think we'll give this a little consideration, ask counsel to look into this a little more. Did you have anything else you wanted to add or any other questions from the committee? Thank you. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 127. And let me move this in order. Hold on. Why don't you stay right there? We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 128, counsel.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm looking at
it. He's lost in research here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 128 comes to you from the Oregon State Police and allows a grand jury that is investigating a charge of failure to report as a sex offender under ORS 181-599, failure to report as a sex offender, to receive and evidence certified copies of a sex offender registration form if accompanied by an affidavit of record keeper of the state police of sex offender records.
Okay. Mr. Mallon.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 128. Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registration...
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sam Allen with the Oregon State Police.
Sorry, I mispronounced your name, by the way. Go ahead.
The State Police Sex Offender Registration Unit staff, as keepers of the state sex offender registration record, are required to appear and testify at grand jury hearings in cases involving persons charged with violations of ORS 181-599, failure to report as sex offender. These appearances involve providing certified copies of the sex offender registration, the sex offender obligation form, and registration form records, providing explanations of the forms and sex offender registration laws as subject matter experts, and confirmation that there are no other forms or registrations in the record. The appearances are required in response to subpoenas, primarily Deuces Tecum subpoenas, which must be honored. In each case, due to the distance from the state police headquarters in Salem to the courthouses, staff members spend over 2 hours of travel time for each grand jury hearing, with testimony rarely lasting more than 3 minutes. ORS 132320 allows grand juries to accept as evidence affidavits of certain reports from medical examiners, physicians, firearm experts, witnesses unable to appear, and peace officers. Senate Bill 128 will modify ORS 132320, authorizing grand juries to accept as evidence certified copies of the obligation form and registration form record and an affidavit stating that the attached record is a complete copy of the record. It should be noted that no more information is provided at these hearings than that which is on the forms, no further knowledge of the registration laws is provided than the information available to the district attorney in statute. Oregon State Police supports the bill and requests your consideration. Passage of the bill could save thousands of dollars in staff time and transportation expenses.
Senator Pazansky.
If I could just put on the record, Detective, what I assume this would do is very similar to what we see as to, let's say, like a breath test, where you have a certified copy that's sent to, in most cases, the prosecutor to introduce as one of the requirements under the administrative law. And it's my understanding for the committee, the breath test machines now that we use, the intoxilizers, are hooked up by a computer, and they do all the testing, I think, in Salem. It may be in Portland, but at a centralized location where they can actually run the test online and find out if the machine is measuring correctly. Once they've accomplished that, it allows them, then they can basically send out to the agencies that the machines are in compliance, show what the difference is, if there is any difference, and that if either the machine is working properly or not. This seems to be an extension of that, where the state police will be able to rely on the records that are that they keep as the keeper of the records, and they can review them, put an affidavit together, and then forward it for as being testimony to be entered into the grand jury proceeding.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazansky, that's correct. The certified copies that we provide now already are stamped and signed with the state seal, and a stamp that reads that as keepers of the state's record, we certify that the copies that we have are complete and accurate, and they're the only copies that are available on the offender in question. So the point is, since there's not this allowance in 132.320, some counties require us to appear in person. And again, sometimes I've appeared at many of these grand jury hearings. Sometimes they only last a minute after traveling for an hour and 15 minutes.
Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Malin, how much money will this save the state police?
Chair Burdick, Counsel Taylor, we estimate it would save between $3,000 and $5,000. It's not a lot of money that we would save, but it's staff time, it's transportation time. The time that's spent by the folks who are traveling to the grand jury hearings is time that they could be used processing registrations and updating the registry.
So in your estimate of how much it would save, you haven't accounted for the lost work, basically, for doing this function as opposed to other functions?
Chair Burdick, it came out to a wash. When we took a look at it, we looked at between $3,000 and $5,000 in savings that would be offset by the cost of postage and, in some cases, overnight postage, because sometimes the DAs need it very quickly for overnight Federal Express delivery or whatever the case might be. So probably it would come out to a wash. We wouldn't really see any significant savings.
Okay.
But we would get some staff time back, and that's probably the most important thing.
Senator Pazansky.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think, Detective, what we're contemplating is whether this is a fair and reasonable trade-off. And it's my understanding these are basically the state police is acting as the keeper of records, so they are the business record keeper. And the question is whether or not we need to have you or someone else travel to whatever county that grand jury is meeting in and actually present as coming from your office. And the reality is there is time that you're going to be on the road, and even though it may be a minute for you to be in actual testimony, then you have to drive back, and that 2 hours, 2.5 hours, you could have been processing other work. And it seems to me that I understand that you want to be cautious as to how much you think the savings could be, but it does seem to me that you're going to actually be using your time more efficiently, which is a savings of time, which is a savings of cost, because that work that wouldn't be done because you're traveling is now getting completed sooner.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazansky, that's correct. It will result in more staff time being available to timely enter registrations into the registry.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Breyer? Okay. All right. Well, normally I like to hang on to things for a day, but this one looks pretty straightforward. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 128, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 128.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 128 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 128 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
Love to.
Good. Okay. You said 2:30 in there. Are you ready on this?
Yes, Joe's here.
Okie dokie. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 581.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 581 comes to you from Senator Porzanski, allows a court to reduce or suspend traffic fines so long as the court does not defer or waive the fine to an amount that is less than the unitary assessment established under state and local law.
Senator Porzanski, did you want to start off by speaking to this bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to, and I also want to ask our staff if they would hand out just the one that's from the city of Tillamook. It's the one from the police department. Madam Chair and committee members, this bill is coming to you at the request, as you can see, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and also the Oregon Justice of Peace Association. These are the associations that represent the municipal court as well as the Justice of the Peace judges. As a prosecutor, I can tell you that I have seen in many cases where the courts, based on the current rule that we have on statute, they are not able to exercise any court discretion in reducing a fine for traffic violations because of how strict the statute is and giving little to no latitude for them to exercise what they think might be a more reasonable or fair type of assessment for an individual who violates a traffic offense, or I should say violations compared to a crime. I've also asked our committee staff to hand out to you a letter that I received from Tillamook Police Department. It's from the Chief of Police, Chief Terry Wright. Chief Wright has written me on two instances. The first couple of paragraphs deal with the bill that we have not heard yet, which is Senate Bill 295. But then at the after the first paragraph, and the second paragraph, he starts talking about the need he believes to have more latitude, at the judicial latitude, as to issuing fines that would be maybe more representative to the offense that's occurred. And we have with us Carl Myers, who is a municipal court judge for Kaiser, also is a advocacy work for, I believe, both the Justice of the Peace as well as the Municipal Court Judges Associations. He can give you his life experiences and what he's heard from, not only what he's seen in his own court, but also what he's heard from other judges. The one point, I guess, other thing I'd like to establish, Mr. Meyer can actually cover this in his presentation, the difference between a person that, let's say, flagrantly violates a violation such as running a stop sign or a red light as compared to someone that might slow down and roll through it, and what, if any, discretion he has in assessing maybe a different penalty based on the conduct.
Welcome to the committee. I didn't know you were a judge.
Madam Chair, to keep that a secret from some, including about 34 gypsy jokers I had in my courtroom last month on a traffic matter. For the record, my name is Carl Myers. I am the municipal court judge in the city of Kaiser. I also represent in this process the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and the Justice of the Peace Association. Senate Bill, and I thank you, Madam Chair, for accommodating my schedule. I came directly from court. I had hearings this afternoon, and I appreciate you holding this later in the session so that I could be here, because this is a very important bill to the judges. 2 years ago, the legislature passed a bill that increased the minimum fine on violations, but including traffic violations, the minimum fine from 50% of the base fine amount. That base fine is the amount that is shown on your ticket, your citation, from 50% to 75%. And by and large, or in most cases, that does not cause the judges a great deal of difficulty. If somebody is speeding or rather flagrantly breaking a traffic law, an increased penalty to fit that 75% minimum fine is not a major problem. But in raising the minimum, there was no exception for lowering the fine in the event of financial hardship or a very clean record. There are a number of cases that give me great
cane, if you will, in levying a fine. I had three of those cases this morning in arraignments, and I will tell you about them. It is against the law when you are making a left-hand turn, and many jurisdictions don't have a problem because they don't have four-lane roads, but in Kaiser we do, and instead of turning into the closest available lane, they make basically a wide turn into the outside lane or into the center lane if they're making a right-hand turn. That is against the law. That is making an illegal right or left-hand turn depending on the direction that you're turning. The legislature has deemed that to be a Class B violation. The base fine on that is $237. The minimum fine that I can impose on those is $178. I had three people today, all my age or older, 60s or 70s, who violated that statute. In each case, I could find no less than $178 for what I deem to be a fairly common mistake, and one in which I would much rather educate than fine. The other problem that I have, a significant problem, is failing to come to a complete stop at a stop sign. That is violation of a traffic control device. That also is a Class B violation. So making a California stop, the minimum fine that I can impose for making a California stop is $178. Now, the people that pay these fines, first of all, a traffic violation is not an intentional crime. It is a basically a status type crime. You did it even if you didn't intend to do it. So most of the people who violate the stop signs and the wide turns and even some of the minor speeding things are people just like you and me who have a momentary lapse of attention or are not completely knowledgeable on everything that the law requires. They are truly sorry that they committed the violation, and quite honestly, having been pulled over by the police officer is probably sufficient enough to get them to do the right thing. But under the current law, if the officer writes a ticket, I am and the person pleads guilty, has a clean record, and maybe even is on fixed income or has no money at all, I must impose a fine of $178. Now, I take into financial consideration in doing so, I am able under the law to extend that out and make fairly small minimum payments. But again, I have no discretion under the current law to go less than $178 for a rather common failing to come to a stop at a stop sign, a complete stop at a stop sign. And I will say, having now been a keen observer of traffic violations for 10 years of my tenure on the bench, I could probably, if I were a police officer, write 100 tickets a day for failing to come to a complete stop at a stop sign, and I would be willing to bet that each of you have committed that violation probably within the last 3 days, if not today, getting here. It is a rather common violation. Doesn't mean that it's right. It's just that a lot of people think they're coming to a complete stop and don't. And in Kaiser, they do write citations for that because, in fact, we've had some accidents crashes that arose out of that. But under the current scenario, I have difficulty imposing such a large fine on people with clean records when, in fact, on a Class B violation, if somebody had a bad record, the maximum fine that I would impose for that same kind of thing would be $237. So under the current schedule at 75% of the base fine, there is just not enough room for me to handle different cases appropriately under the facts, the driving record, taking into consideration the person's age, driving record, various other things that I should in levying an appropriate levying an appropriate fine to fit the offense that occurred. I know there are some problems, technical problems with the bill. There's one section of the bill that I think is that refers to the base fine, and that is not an appropriate reference, but the
the theory of the bill, the giving more discretion back to the local judges to handle this, quite honestly, is a good idea and allows us to do better justice out in traffic court to handle people appropriately under the circumstances. I will say that that bill 2 years ago was put through, and quite honestly, I think the legislature was rather open and honest about why the changes were made, and they were to raise money. But I will go on the record, I do not believe courts should be in the money-raising business. We should be in the justice business. And I think that limiting our discretion, unfortunately, causes us to have to do some injustices from time to time based on our inability to appropriately fine or impose penalties. I would be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Yeah, I was just curious, are you at all concerned about the fiscal impacts of doing this?
Well, I'm sure there are going to, Madam Chair, I'm sure there are going to be here that are going to address that, but the fiscal impacts, but again, I'm in the justice business. I want to make sure that when somebody appears in front of me, admits their guilt, that I am able to do the right thing in terms of a sentencing. I have on my desk at all times a copy of the Oregon Constitutional Article 1, Section 15, which I use as a guideline for imposing penalties. And it says, Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll read, laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded upon these principles: protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. I add to that in my court, in traffic court, education, because in large part I'm there to educate the people to become better drivers as to what the law is and to take into consideration that aspect as well. But in no place in Article, and by the way, Article 1, Section 15 really only involves crimes, but I think traffic matters, traffic violations should be handled under those same precepts. And nowhere in there does it talk about raising money. There may be a fiscal impact to some of the jurisdictions. I will say, I don't think it's as clear as it may be presented, because in fact in Kaiser I've had officers come up to me and say they don't cite for some things that they see, in part because they know what the back end penalty is going to be, and they don't think those kinds of high penalties for those kinds of things are appropriate. There is one officer in Kaiser who's told me he doesn't cite for failing to stop at a school bus on a 5-lane road when the bus is going the opposite direction and the people do not stop, in large part because he knows the minimum fine I can impose is $316 for that, and he thinks that's too high for that kind of violation. So he'll issue a warning or just not bother to pull the person over, even though there is a large safety issue involved in kids crossing to go to the school bus. So there are, officers may feel more inclined, if they know that the judges have more discretion, may be more inclined to actually issue more citations. So we may make up in quantity or in quality, or the total number of fines may go up. I don't know what the revenue loss would be. Quite honestly, in the city of Kaiser, we have not seen a significant rise in our revenue from our traffic crime when that law went into from traffic violations when that law went into effect, due specifically to that. We did raise some revenue, but it was better collection proceedings, not the number of citations that were processed through. So I don't know that you can actually quantitatively and indicate or have an indication as to what the increased revenue from that bill 2 years ago was.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. How much is the unitary assessment?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the unitary assessment on all traffic violations is $37. That will not change under this bill as I read the bill. The state will still get its unitary assessment. The county assessment will remain the same. Quite honestly, the amount that will be lost, if there is again a loss, will be to the local jurisdiction. I might add that all but four municipal judges serve at the pleasure of their council. So if there is a revenue loss, the council, I suspect, can deal with that directly with their judge. That's just a reality of how we operate. I've had many discussions over my tenure with the council out in Kaiser as to how much money was coming in and how much was going out and sort of what their expectations were. Fortunately, I deal with a great council that are more interested in public safety than they are revenue from that particular stream. Nevertheless, that's on the mind of many jurisdictions, and I know at least anecdotally of about three or four judges in the last 2 years who have lost their jobs because they weren't fining enough for the local jurisdiction's benefit. That's a shame, but nevertheless, that occurs out there. So there are some checks and balances in the lost revenue at the local jurisdiction, at least those judges who serve, again, directly at the pleasure of the city council as opposed to independently elected or in some cases the circuit court judges that serve also as municipal judges.
Okay, thank you. More? Any other questions? Thank you very much. We also have, what are you doing with my sign up sheet? Senator Starr.
We heard testimony that the base fine was not a proper designation. What should that say?
Senator Burnick, Vice Chair Starr, I believe it just needs to refer to fine as opposed to base fine, but Brad Swank is here to address that. He's the one that is sort of the author of much of that language dealing with base fines and fines, and I'll let him give his suggestion as to how that might be addressed. But in looking through the bill, that I recognize that was a problem. The local judges do not adjust the base fine unless they raise it. What we're talking about is the actual fine that is imposed, not counting, again, the unitary assessment and the county assessment, which is on top of that fine. But I'll let Mr. Swank address that.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. We do have Mr. Swank signed up. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department, and this bill sort of wanders into, unfortunately, an area of legal esoterica that I have been unable to avoid for most of my career, and that's the base fine issue. I brought the base fine. Let me explain briefly. The base fine is the amount that the officer writes on the front of the ticket. And it's figured by a complicated statutory formula that includes an amount for a fine, an amount for unitary assessment, and an amount for county assessment. And the unitary assessment is a fixed amount, $37 for traffic and higher amounts for other kinds of offenses. The county assessment varies on the amount of the fine, but officers need to know how much they're going to write on the front of the ticket. And a few years ago, the legislature made this a standard amount. If you hand this out, this is the base fine summary that we're mandated to put together. I'm handing out copies if you want, because it used to be that officers in say Baker City weren't writing the same amount on a ticket for speeding at 30 miles over the speed limit as somebody might in Portland. And so in the mid-90s, the legislature put together this structure for base fine amounts, so you're getting issued a ticket for the same amount in Portland and Baker City and Lane County and Klamath Falls and every place. The officers were mandated to write this base fine amount on the front of the ticket. So that base fine amount, a couple of years later, was also tied into a minimum fine that the legislature established. And what the statute said was you can reduce the amount that you impose as a sanction to 50% of the amount that the officer wrote on the front of the ticket, or the base fine amount, and you can go lower if justice requires. And then last session, the legislature raised that amount to 75. CI is closing. If this is way too complicated, I'll stop. Anyway, if you have questions about the base fine summary, which is what we're mandated by statute to put out, it comes in two parts. The first part is for officers, and that runs through page 8.
pages 11 through 24 are the parts that the courts follow, because the officer writes a single amount on the front of the ticket, and then the courts have to break that apart and distribute it. Have to break it apart and distribute it when the judge imposes the sanction at the end. The problem with the bill as written is several, and the first one comes in on page 1 of the bill, in line 14, a court of violations bureau may not defer, waive, suspend, or otherwise reduce the base fine amount of a traffic violation amount that is less than the unitary assessment established by, and then it goes on from that. The court doesn't reduce the base fine amount. It can impose or not impose an amount of a monetary sanction at the end. And that includes fine amount and other amounts. And that's what it's tied to. So the reference to base fine is simply wrong in that legally, as is the reference in line 25, the cross-reference to 153-125. So that doesn't get you where you want to go. Probably you want language that says that the court may not defer, waive, suspend, or otherwise reduce the fine amount imposed to an amount less than the unitary assessment under 137-290 plus the county assessment under 137-309, and you would delete the 153-125 because it's not an appropriate reference, for the offense cited. Because you want to add that, because the county assessment otherwise would fluctuate with the amount of fine that's actually imposed. So when the court lowers the actual fine imposed, the county assessment goes down. So there needs to be language in there. Another couple of points I would make about this bill is it only applies to traffic. The vast majority, creating a level of complication that I'd like to ask you not to go there. And if you look at the base fine summary, this is the base fine summary, and it runs 20 or 11 pages long, very fine lines, very small prints that we hand out to court, that courts use this, the formula on this, to figure how much they're reducing fines. More than 80% of the fines are a handful, less 20 or fewer violations, all of them traffic. And there's extra complication that goes into differentiating those fines that are not traffic. The size of the summary for courts and the complication will have to double. And this is a summary that I actually prepare. It comes off my computer from my desk. We'll have to double if we have to differentiate different kinds of violations, traffic and non-traffic. So we'll be handing more paper to the court for no particular benefit, because most of the offenses that are cited are traffic. So the question is, do you really want to limit this to just traffic?
Yes, sir. I just want to make sure I'm following. Brad, on the suggestions you're making, first of all, it sounds like on the violation where it's currently these traffic violations, we should delete the term traffic in the two places on line 6 and on line 14, and just leaving the term violation.
That's correct. And I suspect when you send this down to counsel's office, they're going to point you, unfortunately, to line 2, which is the relating clause. And they're going to tell you that there's a problem with that. And I know that this has been limited. It's a workload. It adds a level of complication to courts if you limit it to traffic, but I suspect counsel's office will raise the question about the relating clause. The other thing that I would note is that I'd be willing to work with anybody on the language that goes in lines 13 through 16 to make sure it's correct. But one thing I noted in this, there's no standard that you set for when judges could reduce the amount of the fine that they actually impose. Is it based on justice? Is it based on good driving record? Is it based on
discretion?
Yeah. Discretion. Okay, and that's fine. We have been, as you know, traditional supporters of judicial discretion. But if you want no guidelines, then there will be no guidelines, is all I'm saying. The other thing I thought I'd give you some information, the revenue stream that comes out of the unitary assessment stream has increased as we've increased
collections and those sorts of things, you're talking roughly $100 million revenue stream that comes through the criminal fines and assessments stream that this is tied to. And that's how much money ends up in the state. The vast majority, and it includes all revenues from traffic offenses, from costs imposed by courts, from fines that the state collects and those sorts of things. That's the size of the revenue stream. We did a study just before the discretion was removed from courts last session, and we discovered that by and large the average monetary sanction that was being imposed by courts, circuit courts, that we can gather information from, was right about the very, very close to the minimum fine that was imposed by the legislature, even when the legislature gave courts discretion. And that's just a piece of information when you're thinking about this. I can answer questions about this. If you have questions about the base fine summary that was handed out and how that works and what that means, how the courts disperse the monies, that's something I can answer. Any other questions you've got?
Okay, thank you for this information. It's a constant learning experience here in Senate Judiciary. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you. We have Mark Lear and Mark Landau, I presume, from the City of Portland.
Good afternoon. Mark Landau with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. I've asked Mark Lear to appear before you to discuss Senate Bill 581 and to share with you the city's concerns related to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. My name is Mark Lear, City of Portland, Office of Transportation. I manage the Traffic Investigations Group as well as our Community School and Traffic Safety Program. A staff that I manage of 13 people deal on a regular basis with citizens calling in when their kid was almost hit or a crash has occurred in their neighborhood. And unfortunately, this is a really serious issue for us and causes us to oppose the bill. In the City of Portland, we have basically a fatality every week, a traffic fatality average every week over the last 10 years. One out of every three of those fatalities is a pedestrian or a bicyclist. Every 3 days a child is hit. Two-thirds of those crashes resulted in a pedestrian or a bicyclist, results in the child having to be hospitalized. So for us, this is an incredibly serious issue. In addition to that, federal studies would indicate that 93% of traffic crashes are the result of some kind of human error. I think the earlier testimony was right that we often, as drivers, make mistakes, but sometimes those mistakes have really significant impacts. And I think that the state generally, and Portland specifically, have done a lot to make sure that our enforcement is being done to improve public safety. For example, we recently established safe corridors in Portland. There's 31 corridors that were identified for the purposes of deploying our police forces, photo radar. Those 31 corridors include 50,000 crashes over the last 15 years, and they cover 85% of our highest collision intersections. So I think, you know, we're doing a lot to improve to make sure that we're writing tickets based on behavior that's causing crashes and in those locations. The other piece I would add is that some of the standards and practices used by police really make sure that we're identifying drivers that are, you know, they may not realize it, but are doing things that are really increasing the risk. So, for example, there's a standard practice out there that police officers won't write tickets in a residential zone, in a 25-mile-an-hour zone, until someone's going 11 miles an hour over the speed limit, or 36 miles per hour. At that speed, it takes an additional half block for a car to stop. And if you strike a pedestrian, the chance that you're going to kill that pedestrian, let me make sure I get the numbers right, goes up from 22% at 25 miles per hour to 65% at 36 miles an hour. So for us, again, these are some of the reasons why we're real concerned with anything that sort of lowers the seriousness, I think, for us of the issue. In addition to that, we've really worked hard with our traffic safety community. I've included a handout that includes Traffic Safety Coordination Council that we've set up in Portland. We set this up. All of our fine revenue goes to the general fund, but we wanted to make sure that when we got this increased revenue, that we were using the courts, chief of police, director of transportation, trauma nurses, school district superintendents, the Vermont Pedestrian Coalition, or Bicycle Transportation Alliance, to make sure that we took that revenue and used it most effectively to address this public safety issue. So we've provided resources for Safe Routes to School. We're funding a speakers bureau with the help of Elders in Action to go out and talk about what seniors need to think about when they're crossing streets and what drivers need to think about when they see seniors trying to cross streets. All of these things are, to a degree, we get to fund them because of these general fund resources. Just the last thing I guess I'd mention is that we, in Portland specifically, are in a hard position. If you think about the average fine, at least before the increases, of being $100. The first $37, as you heard, goes to the unitary assessment. At $100, the next $20 goes to the county. There's $50 left, or a little less. In our case, half of that goes to the state court. So on a $100 ticket, only $25 is coming back to us. In summary, we feel that the current fine levels provide that significant tool to educate, provide a penalty to drivers for breaking those laws, and we think we have systems in place that make sure that we're writing tickets appropriately.
Got it, Chair. How long is the city block? How many feet?
200 feet. When I was referring to a city block, I was referring to a standard city block in downtown Portland, which is 200 feet.
That might make a little better sense then.
Yeah. So basically we were saying with the difference between 25 and 35 is basically adding 100 feet to your stopping distance. Part of why that seems probably longer than you might think about just in braking time is there's also perception reaction time that's included in that 100 feet. So, which is standard when engineers sort of think of that, they think about a 1.5 to 2 second reaction time. So if you see something before you get a chance to realize that it's there and to start to, to start the braking process.
1.5 to 2 second reaction time?
Yeah, it's obviously in certain cases you'd be faster than that, but then you have to think about when you drop the French fry or your kid screaming in the back seat, those sort of things. So it's sort of an average.
Okay, Senator Krasanski.
Mr. Lehrer, I'm trying to follow your rationale and reasoning as to why you don't think courts should have the discretion to potentially lower it. What I've heard you say is when you use the money that you make to provide for these safety programs, what I also hear is that you think that it's reasonably fixed at this point. But based on your data that you're showing how many accidents you're having, how many fatalities, how many injuries, wouldn't it make sense that you should be here telling us that we should be jacking these fines up 2 or 3 times as much to get more effectiveness?
Senator Przanski, I guess from my perspective, I think we do need to be have some balance in what the fine amounts need to be so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where officers are not willing to write tickets, judges aren't willing to find people guilty for those offenses. My sense in what I've been hearing and talking to neighbors and our traffic safety community is they feel like the fine levels, the way that they were established last session, feel right to them. I'm not hearing a lot of outcry from people that are saying, boy, I'm getting a lot of tickets for rolling through a stop sign and I'm having to pay this high amount. I just don't hear those things. We have an 823 safe line in Portland, and we encourage people when we got to neighborhood meetings, if you think you got a ticket and it wasn't appropriate, whether it was as a bicyclist, a driver, a photo radar, any of those things, we encourage you to call our 823 safe line. We on a regular basis go and meet with our circuit, our presiding judge, and we'll talk about the locations where people feel like we're doing something that's not driven by safety. So we're looking at those issues. But I guess bottom line, I'd say we're constantly having to achieve sort of a balance of what fine level is appropriate.
The comment was made from Judge Myers that officers were not issuing tickets because they were using their discretion, if you will, to not impose what they considered too serious a penalty. Are you seeing that at all in Portland?
I don't know of specific examples like that. However, part of what is really exciting about our Traffic Safety Coordination Council and having the presiding judge there, the chief of police there, as well as the traffic safety community, is we're having a lot more of those kinds of conversations. They've come up, I think, more around, for us, around pedestrian and bicycle issues, both violations that would be against the drivers as well as the pedestrian bike community. So we're planning this summer to do more trainings with our police officers involving the courts, at least in summaries of how those go, to make sure that there's a better understanding of the kind of enforcement actions that are really driven to improve safety and why, you know, the fines are what they are. And we've tried at least once a year to have a joint meeting with all the traffic referees for our circuit court to help get feedback from them and provide them feedback as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We also have signed up Ed Johnston.
He's not here.
Doesn't seem to be here. Okay, well, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 581, and we're going to have to roll traffic day over till tomorrow. Senate Bill 290.
Madam Chair.
Well, if we roll it, we may end up with a couple of these. Shouldn't take too much time. So,
okay.
If we roll until tomorrow, we can move them. So we could roll 295, 546, 568, and 592 to tomorrow's meeting. And it's a very busy meeting tomorrow, so we may not get through them. If not, we will roll them over again. And we will move Senate Bill 333 to the and 913 and 965 to Monday's meeting. Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Roger, are we on at 3?